org.
Good afternoon. It's almost 3 o'clock. You're listening to KTOO in Juneau. It's time for another edition of a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Ken Fix. I'll be your host for today. On the show, we'll be talking with Joe Orsi about Saturday's Garlic Lovers Potluck. We'll learn about the fourth annual Grand Poetry Slam. Bonnie Herbold of Herbside Herbs. Well, it's Riverside Herbs, will highlight her home-based vinegar and olive oil business. And the High School Career Center's Terry Calvin will be here to talk about this year's college fair. These guests, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and some more for Tuesday, October 14th, 2014. Stay with us. National Native News is up first.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Over the last few months, the nonpartisan Get Out the Native Vote movement has made a push to mobilize Native voters across Alaska, which make up nearly 15% in the state. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Since she was a teenager, Sarah Obed has been heavily involved in the election process.
In fact, I was in the Peace Corps in a remote outer island in the South Pacific. And I voted absentee. So yes, I pride myself on my voting history.
Obed now works as the vice president of external affairs for Doyon Limited. In Interior Alaska, the Native Corporation partners with Tanana Chiefs Conference and the Fairbanks Native Association on a nonpartisan effort to encourage Alaska Natives and tribal members to vote.
In Alaska in particular, there's a huge population of Alaska Natives that we have a power at the polls to make a difference just in terms of the sheer numbers of Alaska Native people, provided we turn out to vote.
This year, the Alaska Federation of Natives and the Association of Alaska Regional Native Corporation Leaders, as well as Get Out the Native Vote, worked with the State Division of Elections to establish 128 new absentee and in-person early voting sites across Alaska. In the Interior region this summer, Get Out the Native Vote volunteers registered or updated information for more than 200 people. That's down about 100 voters from 2012, but Sarah Obed doesn't seem to mind.
Maybe it's because we were very effective in 2012 that we had less people registering, updating their information this year.
Statewide, Get Out the Native Vote has registered more than 1,200 shareholders and tribal members this year. But that number could be conservative. The organization is still awaiting a final count. For National Native News, I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
In South Dakota today, the Oglala Sioux tribal primary election is being held on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Voters are choosing tribal council members. There's also a three-way race for president. Julie Two Eagle is an election commissioner. She says more than 3,500 votes were cast in the 2012 primary on Pine Ridge. Two Eagle says election officials are pushing for a bigger turnout this year.
We've done a lot of outreach via newspaper, via radio, and via with different district service centers. So we're hoping for a bigger outcome, or essentially our goal is probably a better outcome than the year prior.
In the race for president, the incumbent Brian Brewer faces challengers John Yellowbird Steele and Harold Eagle Bull. The top two will be on the November 4th ballot, which coincides with the general election in the state. A group of indigenous people in California spoke out against the Columbus Day holiday while celebrating their cultures. Will Robbins has more.
Nearly 600 Native Americans gathered on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay just before sunrise Monday to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day and commemorate 522 years of Indigenous resistance. Andrea Carmen from the Yaqui Nation addressed the group, calling for an end to the Columbus Day celebration and urging other communities to follow the example set forth by a now growing list of cities across the United States.
We adamantly object, and we have to make our voices heard to call this day a celebration or a holiday. We salute those cities like Berkeley and Minneapolis and Seattle that have changed the name to Indigenous Peoples Day. Let's keep changing the name.
The event put a spotlight on Indigenous people's history and drew away from the celebration of Columbus. It was sponsored by the International Indian Treaty Council. For National Native News, I'm Will Robbins reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Science, technology, engineering, and math students thrive at New Mexico Tech. Personalized instruction, rigorous curricula, undergrad research opportunities. New Mexico Tech, where the smart kids go. Info in Winds of Change magazine or visit nmt.edu.
If you are a Native American, there's one simple thing you can do to help your elders, help young people seeking an education, and help develop Native business. Go out and vote on November 4th. Voting on Election Day makes a difference in Washington, D.C. and at home. Go to nativenews.net for more information. Brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Kawanak Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
3:05 p.m. You're listening to KTOO in Juneau. And my first guest is Joe Orsi, and he's going to be talking about Saturday's Garlic Lovers Potluck. Hi, Joe. It's a pleasure to have you on the show with us.
Hi, Ken. How you doing?
Doing great. All right. Let's go over a little bit about garlic, because I love it. I just crock-potted a roast today with garlic and onions, coincidentally. So garlic is right on topic for today.
Okay. I guess for starters, again, I could just say that it's a real good crop for growing in Juneau. And you plant it in the fall, you harvest it in the middle of summer, and it keeps probably 6 to 12 months, depending on how you take care of it.
All right, and let's go over a little bit about the history of garlic. Has it been indigenous to the United States, or was it brought here from elsewhere?
I believe it was brought here from elsewhere. Probably the, you know, just like apples, you know, came over from the Stan area and, you know, Black Sea, and just kind of made its way across the Silk Road, and people just started growing it in different areas, and different varieties kind of found their way to popularity, and now there's, I think, about 400 different varieties.
Yeah, I don't think that it was at all indigenous to here, but I'm surprised to find out that we're the eighth in world production for garlic. We're beaten out by China big time.
Right.
China produces 13 million tons of garlic each year, and the United States produces about 170,000 tons of garlic each year.
Yeah, they also beat us on apples, too, so go figure.
Well, and plus they're making everything else. All right.
Yeah.
Well, let's go over a little bit about the construction of a garlic plant. What parts of it that we have are edible? We know about the bulbs, but what other pieces are there on this plant?
Well, if you grow the hardneck variety, which is the kind that I'm mainly focusing on, because it's more cold tolerant than the softneck, they have what's called a scape that forms from a central stalk in the middle of it to the bulbs that the cloves grow around in a circular fashion. And that scape will come up in May and June, and it kind of look like a little snake head, and it'll go up to the sky, and then it'll take a turn, and it, depending on the variety, it may do a corkscrew, or it may just go off 90 degrees. But those scapes taste kind of like, taste like garlic and like asparagus, and they're good, you know, a stir fry, that you can use in the early summer. And you want to cut those off too, because if you let them form all the way, they'll actually produce a flower that will get pollinated, and I'll have bulbs, and it will rob the, energy out of the bulb. And the bulbs will be very small if you let the scapes continue to grow and turn into flowers.
All right, so it's kind of like the process of picking asparagus. You want to get them when they're just starting to shoot up out of the ground, and boy, they grow fast.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think garlic doesn't grow anywhere near as fast as asparagus, does it?
Probably, you know, I'm not familiar with asparagus, but, I mean, you can grow knee-high garlic by the 4th of June, you know, here. It does grow really well. It likes our cool springs, as long as you give it a lot of fertilizer and good drainage and lots of light, and it'll do well for you.
Now, lately, I've been thinking the garlic would be drowned here with the amount of rain we've gotten. But how hardy are they as far as precipitation? Are they very tolerant of this kind of environment here?
Well, you kind of have to work with the knowledge that most all plants need to have, you know, soil that's damp but not soaked, because if it gets soaked soaked, it's anaerobic, and it will rot things. So you want to grow things in either a raised bed or a raised mound. And the way I do it is I elevate my mounds about 8 inches off the ground, and they kind of crown at 12 inches at the top, and then they go down. So it basically it's about 3 foot wide from mound to mound. And then I just kind of alternate a pattern of 3-2 all the way down the row at a spacing of about 6 inches. And I usually plant about anywhere 1,500 to 2,000 a year.
In addition, are they growing by that many per year?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So that's actually taken off in leaps and bounds then.
Well, actually, I think Ed Biarski, he's got his partnership with a guy, George Campbell, up in Haynes, and they've got a regular farm up there, and they're really starting to produce a lot. I know they kind of had a issue this last year with all the rain, but you know, if you can kind of tend it and use some covering techniques like tarp it off in the fall, and then you know untarp it in the spring, that really helps keep the soil dry over winter. And you know, you want to mulch it because the purpose of the mulching, basically adding some seaweed or some kind of a vegetative matter on top of it, because what that does is it prevents the freeze-thaw cycle from turning, you know, waking it up in the middle of winter when you don't want it to wake up. You want it to go down in the late fall, like around Halloween. You want it just to stay fairly dormant until like early April, and then you uncover it, and then it'll grow. But if you just let it in the open, it'll just get rained on, and it could prematurely wake up, and then you'll have some dieback. But garlic, it's pretty tough stuff. I mean, I plow snow around the yard here, and eventually, and every once in a while, I find some derelict plants that are just kind of growing in the snowbank. So they can definitely handle the harsh elements.
Okay, that's. I was wondering about garlic storage. Most people either have them in, you know, a bag in the kitchen, or they store them in the refrigerator. Which is the preferred method, and how long will they last either way?
Okay, like a lot of plants, once garlic gets its chill requirements, doesn't necessarily have to be frozen, but below, I think it's like 45 degrees or something like that. If it gets so many hours, then that will trigger it to start growing. So to make it keep the longest, you want to keep it at room temperature in a dark, well-ventilated place. And that way you can keep it for like up to a year. But if you put it in your refrigerator, that's the worst thing you can do, because that will initiate some, for it to break dormancy after so many hours. And then it will start, you know, growing. You'll get that green stuff in the middle. And,
yeah, that's so, that's, I've seen that.
Yeah. And unless you grow it yourself, Ken, you don't know the history on it. So you may get some garlic in the store and you see it out there. Oh, here's some nice stuff, but it could have been in the refrigerator for 6 months before it ended up on the shelf there. And, you know, whatever you do afterwards is kind of a moot point, because it's already met its dormancy requirements. It's going to sprout anyway.
All right. And how should we pick it when we're in the store? What should you be looking for when you pick a clove of garlic?
Well, I'm told that you don't really want to get the stuff from China, because they use human waste in a lot of their fertilizing techniques, and which isn't too sanitary. And they supposedly clip those off really tight to the roots, clip tight to the bulb. But I guess you want to feel the bulb and just feel how desiccated it is. You don't want it to be dry at all. You want it to be really firm and not rubbery at all. And yeah, I guess other than that, you can smell it and make sure it doesn't smell sulfury or you know, kind of rancid, obviously. But garlic will, when it gets old, it'll get kind of a sulfury smell to it.
What about medicinal purposes? What has garlic been used for traditionally?
I think it's a natural anti-inflammatory and has some antibiotic properties, too. I think I read somewhere where they actually used it in World War II or one as a kind of an antibiotic on wounds. But it's kind of a thing where the best garlic you can eat is the fresh stuff, because the enzyme in it, I think it's called allease or something like that, once it reacts with water, then it gives you that allease, that enzyme, I think that's real beneficial. So if you eat it fresh, that's the best. And you basically just, once you mince it and it mixes with water, then you get that reaction and you get that beneficial enzyme that's good for you. But I like to make it into powder too, cut it into wafers and then dry the wafers at low temperature, blend them, and then make a powder and then store the powder in the refrigerator, and then you can use that for years basically, because it'll stay real potent for a long time as long as you don't, get it moist.
And what about the potluck that's coming up? What dishes have been prepared that you've seen with garlic that are unusual? Something that somebody's come up with and it's like, wow, I didn't realize we could do that with garlic.
You know, one thing somebody showed me, and I've tried it and it works pretty good, is with roasts. If you just get like a fillet knife and you just jab, poke holes in the roast, and you get cloves of garlic and you shove them in the middle of the roast, and that'll, just really, just infuse the dish with the garlicky flavor, and then you get the garlic to eat afterwards. And, of course, you want to use, nice, fresh, hardneck garlic, locally grown Juneau here, and, of course, tastes the best. I'm a little biased, but, that's one thing that I learned to do that's kind of neat. And I like just eat, frying it with olive oil and eggs, and it's, I just love the smell of fresh garlic. If you haven't smelled fresh garlic, I'd encourage you to come to this little get-together, because we'll have some cloves of different varieties that you can actually, crush and smell. And it's nothing like the stuff you get in the store. It's completely, it's the next level of flavor and just odor.
All right, Joe, you've got the listeners' interest and certainly mine. Let's talk about the Saturday event for the Garlic Lovers Potluck.
Well, I'm kind of coming in late on it. I was just asked to, to show up and talk about garlic, and I was going to bring some different powders for people to sample just to get a feel for what the different varieties taste like. And then, like you say, I think we'll have some cucumbers that we'll sprinkle a little powder on and maybe do a taste test to see which one wins out as the best flavored. And then I think people are going to bring different dishes. It's going to be like a potluck. And if anyone has any questions about how to grow garlic or problems they might be having with the garlic that they're growing, we'd be happy to answer those.
All right, Joe. And tell everybody where and when the event's going to take place.
Okay, I'm outside working on my high tunnel, so I'm thinking what the email said was at the canvas.
Okay, yeah, I've got it. I was going to let you do it. Yeah, it's October 18th. It's this Saturday at the canvas, 223 Seward Street, and it's from 2 to 3 p.m., free to the public, and potluck. Bring a dish if you want to share something that you've created with garlic with the rest of the Juneau population. You can learn more about garlic. Joe is going to be there to answer questions. And this is sponsored all by the Juneau Garden Club. So everybody, Saturday, 2 to 3 p.m. at the Canvas. It's like right across from where up around the corner from KTOO Studios. And 2 to 3 p.m., potluck, probably have a lot of different things to try that have garlic in them. And, of course, it keeps the vampires away with Halloween coming up. All right. Joe Orsi, thank you very much for being our first guest on the show today.
Okay, my pleasure. Have a great day.
You too. All right. And now I've got a song that I've never heard before, but it's Claudia Schmidt and Sally Rogers' song, The Garlic Waltz.
There are spices and vegetables that you can grow. Some are under the ground, some grow tall. Though they all have their qualities, this you must know, that the garlic is best of them all. Egyptians, Phoenicians, the Vikings, the Greeks, Babylonians, Danes, and Chinese on their voyages took enough garlic for weeks, and their enemies died on the breeze. Since biblical times, in all parts of the earth, it has cured countless sufferings and ills. Oh, if we understood what the garlic is worth, we would throw out our poisonous pills. In Bulgaria's mountains and Russia's white plains, people live to 100 years old. For it's juice of the garlic that runs in their veins. Oh, it's worth
twice its weight in pure gold. With selenium, germanium, allicin too, it can fight off all types of disease. So if you've got arthritis, TB, or the flu, just say, peel me a garlic clove, please. Plant some cloves in your garden to keep away worms and the other bad things that kill plants. If you're one of those people concerned about germs, you can drop one or two in your pants. There are spices and vegetables that you can grow. Some are under the ground, some grow tall. Though they all have their qualities, this you must know, that the garlic is best of them all. Oh, the garlic is best of them all. Yes, the garlic is best of them all.
Ready for that surprise finish there. All right, that's Claudia Schmidt and Sally Rogers with a garlic waltz. All right, and my next guest on the show today is Mike Christensen, and he's here to talk about the 4th Annual Grand Poetry Slam. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you. The garlic waltz, not to be confused with the Gemini waltz.
Yeah, that's two different things.
Going to be one of the opening performers for the 4th Annual Grand Slam, Wishkanadi Grand Slam. It's our fourth year. It's going to be this Friday at the Jack, and there's a $5 to $10 donation, and it's the big cap off to our fourth season, and there'll be a lot of things, a lot of different opening performances going on to open up. Katie Bausler and Henry Melville and people like that, and I'm going to be one of the Grand Slammers along with David Parrish, Max Suzuki, Nathan Block, and Bill Merck.
All right, Mike, and is this your first time performing for the Wishkanadi?
This, you know that there's an Alaska Poet Laureate. Mm-hmm. I am the Alaska Poet Bridesmaid. I've performed every year, and I usually come in third. So I like to say on any given day I'm the third best slam poet in Alaska. So maybe this year.
All right. Do you have any fears about performing?
Generally speaking, poetry is kind of a solitary activity, and a lot of poets would really prefer to just write and then crawl and hide under the desk. So they're not like actors at all. We write our words down, and I have not gotten over the anxiety, the pre-show anxiety at all, even after doing this for 30 years. So it doesn't seem to go away.
All right. And who was last year's winner?
Guy Unzicker.
Okay.
He was just a phenomenal poet. Great performer, wonderful way with words. And he's going to be the sacrificial poet, so he's going to go up and let the judges zero in their scores on him before they get into the real competition.
All right, and let's go a little bit through the elimination process. How does that work?
Well, there are three rounds and five judges, and all of the audience. And we go through the first round, and they score each poet, and they throw out the top score and the bottom score, and they add those together. And then half move forward from that to the second round, and then to the final round, which is two poets going head-to-head.
And how many people have signed up so far?
Well, this is the Grand Slam, so there's you have to have won one of the month before.
Right. It is a monthly event. Yeah.
So theoretically we could have 11 poets, but some people have moved out of town. And I think we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 poets competing.
All right. And let's go over again exactly when and where this is going to take place.
This is going to be this Friday at 7 p.m. at the Jack. There's a suggested donation of $5 to $10. The Breezy Street Fair will be there with food for sale if people are hungry. And there will be cake after the show for our fourth birthday.
Right. And is there a website where anybody can go for additional information? Or is it just on the Jack's calendar? It's probably on the Jack calendar.
It's on the Jack's calendar. And if you use Facebook and type in Whoosh, that will bring you to the Whoosh Kanade
Right. The spelling there. Kanade is a little bit tough.
I can never do those accents. Yeah. I don't know where those reside on the keyboard.
Yeah, that's... the Whoosh part, I think everybody can get, though. All right, Mike Christensen, thank you very much for being our guest on the show today, and good luck with the Poetry Slam.
Thanks a lot.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 14th of October, 2014. It's the birthday of Edward Estlin Cummings, E.E. Cummings, born Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1894. His father was a professor at Harvard. Cummings grew up in a happy household, he said, a home which the truth of my parents' love made joyous. He graduated from Harvard. He was not a great student. Went down to Greenwich Village to write poetry. His first book came out in 1923, Tulips and Chimneys. Cummings was not happy about the fact that the editor had cut the manuscript down from 152 poems to 66. But his reputation slowly grew. His collected poems came out in 1938. It was a big success, though not such that he was able to support himself. His mother still sent him a check every month to help pay his living expenses. He started giving poetry readings, and he was very good at that. His readings were very popular. He was an energetic reader. He strode around the stage as he spoke. 1957, he read to a crowd of 7,000 in Boston. And by the time he died in 1962, Cummings was the second most widely read poet in America after Robert Frost. It was on this day in 1066, William the Conqueror defeated the English at the Battle of Hastings. He came over from France with 10,000 men to fight Harold II, who was trying to fight off his brother and an army of Vikings. Harold brought his army down to meet Williams. The Normans gathered in position, the archers in front, infantrymen behind, knights in the rear. And they pretended to retreat twice, which lured the Englishmen from their positions, and the Normans then turned and annihilated them. And the Normans moved on to London, where William I was crowned on December the 25th. It's the birthday of Dwight D. Eisenhower, Denison, Texas, 1890, graduated from West Point. He was assigned to train soldiers. He wanted to go overseas to fight in World War I, but it ended a week before he was scheduled to go. In 1939, he was stationed at a base in Louisiana, where he supervised the largest military games ever carried out in this country, which was designed to help prepare for a land war in Europe. And Eisenhower planned the strategy for the invading army. And after Pearl Harbor, he was put in charge of the Allied invasion of Europe. And it's the birthday of the short story writer Catherine Mansfield, born Wellington, New Zealand, 1888. Before she became a writer, she was a wild bohemian in New Zealand, had affairs with men and with women. Catherine Mansfield, who said, "Why be given a body if you have to keep it shut up in a case like a violin?" Here's a poem by E.E. Cummings on his birthday, "Love is More Thicker Than Forget." Love is more thicker than forget, more thinner than recall, more seldom than a wave is wet, more frequent than to fail. It is most mad and moonly, and less it shall unbe than all the sea, which only is deeper than the sea. Love is less always than to win, less never than alive, less bigger than the least begin, less littler than forgive. It is most sane and sunly, and more it cannot die than all the sky, which only is higher than the sky. E.E. Cummings, from his Complete Poems, published by Grove Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, working with medical professionals to diagnose hearing disorders and prescribe solutions. Northland Audiology and Hearing Services. Information at 789-6780.
You're tuned to KTOO Juno. This is a Juno afternoon. I'm Ken Fix, your host. My next guest is Bonnie Herbold. She's representing Riverside Herbs, and she's going to highlight her home-based vinegar and olive oil business. Welcome to the show, Bonnie.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Let's go over, how did you get started in this business, and when did it start?
Well, I retired and from work and had to have something to do, and a friend of mine had started a store down in Washington, and so he sent me up some boxes, and I took them to a market because I do gardening and sell plants and that sort of thing. And I just opened up the boxes, and people tried it, and I went, wow, they're loving it. But it all goes back to 1971 when I first tasted Greek Korinneki olive oil. I was on the island of Corfu, and I was there for about 4 months, and that was the kind of olive trees that they had. And my daughter was born at that time, too, so it was a very emotional and happy time. And it took 40 years for me to taste of that Korinneki oil again. And it was just took me back. It was emotional. And that oil, however, came from Chile. So over the years, apparently, a lot of places, like in South America, Argentina, Chile, and so forth, have started olive oil growing. And the company that is importing is called Veronica Foods, and they're located in Oakland. And on Veronica's side of the family, they were the first importers, and they started importing in 1924 on the West Coast. And they were Italian descended, and apparently didn't find olive oil in this country, and so they were determined to bring it here. Also, the other part of the business is balsamic vinegars. And they come from a very special place called Modena, Italy. And anything that is not coming from that location is not considered balsamic vinegar. Now, part of the process with that is It's really wonderful quality stuff. And when I set up my tables at my markets, and I am going to be at the public market this year in the Jack, and this will be my third year there, and or fourth year, and I set out a display which people can sample. Now, where do you get a chance to sample excellent olive oil and excellent balsamic vinegars at a store?
Not very often. Costco, maybe, if you're lucky, but probably not.
Yeah, so this is an opportunity of tasting something and deciding if you want to try it again or buy it.
Yeah, usually you're just buying by looking at a bottle, and you really don't know what it's going to taste like.
Exactly. So I have really good bread that's baked for me here in town from Breezin, and it's a sourdough bread, and usually you can use that for dipping. But if people are intolerant for bread products or something, I have little plastic jars that you can sip out of. So I always have a setup on my table that is showing the different types of olive oil that are what are considered extra virgin olive oils. These are oils that are pressed, but they do not have anything added to them. So it's just the natural cultivar. And they come in different potencies. So there's a mild, a medium, and a robust. And so you can determine what kind of oil is best for you by tasting it. And that way you have another experience of understanding how your mouth reacts to olive oil.
And what would you recommend for cooking?
I cook with it all.
Okay.
And the main thing is that I order the product from them, and they have characteristics of the oils listed that are chemical analysis. And so they are testing every time they're at every press. And they do the testing, and they determine if they're going to buy that oil or not. So they're looking for very high quality and chemistry that's going to allow the oil to last a long time. Both olive oil and vinegar are just on my counter. The olive oil should never be refrigerated, and because that will cause it to change. And it has a long life. I over the 4 years that I've been bottling, nothing has ever gone bad, and it's still sitting on my counter. And when I cook, I'm pretty, because I have vast choices, I just am a random cooker. And then I haven't tasted anything bad yet.
Well, I'll have to tell you right off that I share your love for Greece. I've been there twice, and it's just fabulous. So that's one country that I would go back to again in a heartbeat. What is the difference in the different kinds of oils that you get from different locations?
Well, that was what I thought was interesting with just my own first comparison with the Koroneki. It tasted exactly as my mouth remembered it. It was just so exciting. And I thought to myself at that time, though I don't know if this is the true truth of it, that they must have exactly the same climate, similar soils, and that kind of thing. So there are about 700 varieties of olive tree. And not all of them are edible, but it's interesting that it's a large family.
Right. And where can people encounter you next if they want to sample your products and possibly buy something?
Okay. I always am at the second Saturday farmers market that's at the airport shopping mall. And that's on the second Saturday. And so the date changes, and it runs from 10 until 3 in the afternoon.
Okay, so that wouldn't be this Saturday then, because you've already had that.
It was last Saturday.
Yes, it was last Saturday.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next chance to encounter you is probably going to be in the beginning of November then.
That is correct.
All right.
And I'm not sure of that date right now, but it is the second Saturday. Just look at your calendar, and you can figure it out. And the other thing is that I can be reached at home if somebody knows what they want or wants to come over. I'm open to that.
All right, Bonnie. And do you have a website or an email that somebody could use to reach you?
I have riversideherbsevoo at gmail.com.
All right. So if anybody wants to email Bonnie and inquire about her products, that is where you would go. And what size do your olive oils come in? What size bottles do you bottle?
I usually put the balsamic vinegar in a 200 milliliter bottle, and I also use the 375 for the oil.
Okay, and can you talk about price on the air or not?
Well, I'll say this. Olive oils are varying prices, so from $15 to $19.
Oh, that's still pretty reasonable. All right.
For the quality it is, really.
Oh, yeah. All right, Bonnie Herbold, thank you very much for coming in here and talking about your home business for Riverside Herbs.
Thank you very much.
Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Remember me. Was a true love of mine. Tell her to make me a cowrick shirt of a deep forest green. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. And snow crested cloud without no steam or lights and echoes. Seems unaware of a cloudy and calm. Tell her to find me as a girl of a sprinkling of leaves. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and ashes that are outside. Between the salt water and sunset strands and moon, she'll be tell her to reap it in a sickle of blazing in scarlet battalion. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. And gather it all at the banner shall heavens may long ago forget. She'll be a true love of mine.
Boy, I'm going to have to jump in on that one because it sounds like it's coming off of a cassette player that's got a warped capsin or something. So that was actually a CD, folks, and it doesn't normally sound that way. Oh, well. It's 3:42. You're listening to a Juno Afternoon. My next guest is Terry Calvin. She's here to talk about this year's college fair going on October 16th at the Juno Douglas High School. Welcome, Terry, to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the college fair.
All right. It's a college fair is being hosted this year, as you had mentioned, at Juno Douglas High School. We alternate sites, and so this year it's at Juno Douglas. We have about 50 schools, universities, and career tech ed folks coming in to talk to our students about the opportunity of going to their colleges.
All right. And are we going to have several different representatives? Who's coming?
Yeah, we've got a great list this year. We've got folks coming from Linfield College. We've got folks coming from, of course, all the UA schools, UAS, UAF, and UAA. We've got some folks coming from Mayville in North Dakota coming to talk to our students. We've also got several military academies coming in. We've got the Navy, the Air Force, and the Marines all coming as well this year, which is a great pleasure because last year we didn't have them due to federal budget cuts and all. They didn't.
Oh, yeah, I know about that.
Yeah. So they weren't able to come last year. So it's really great to see them back and able to talk to our students this year.
All right. And as far as the representatives coming here, are they going to be going into any detail about what kind of curriculum they offer and any prerequisites that people need to meet before they apply for college?
Yeah, so the protocol is that we actually set them up in the gym, and it's kind of an open forum. They have tables, booths in the gym, and then the students are just allowed to go from table to table to talk to the different reps, asking them whatever questions that they have of the reps of their schools, whether it's their requirements, whether it's SAT scores, whether the climate is nice at their school, what kind of scholarships they may give. And so the kids just have an opportunity to have some one-on-one time with the reps as they walk through the gymnasium and talk to different school reps. And they often have little handouts. They will collect postcards from the students, so parents, don't be surprised if the students start getting lots of mail, because they'll have them fill out postcards and start sending them literature. It's really great that since it is hosted at JDHS, we actually bus down the Thunder Mountain juniors and seniors in the morning. And so the Thunder Mountain kids, as well as Yakus, and then we've got some eighth grade kids coming in as well in the morning to inundate and enjoy the reps. And then in the afternoon, we have the JDHS kids will come in and go through. And then we have a really great opportunity for parents and students alike to come in together and share the experience by at 5 o'clock, from 5 to 6. We have a community open forum so that the community can come in and have conversations as well. So highly encourage parents to come in during 5 and 6 with their students. Their students have been there during the day and have had a chance to talk to some of these reps, and it just kind of gives them that opportunity to talk a little bit more.
And do we have financial and relocation counselors as well?
No, unfortunately, we do not.
Okay, none of them. All right.
That must be some coming from your little federal cutback.
All right. Yeah, well, it's, you know, because a lot of people are always curious about the process as far as, you know, how do we pay for this? You know, do we get loans? How do we get into this? And
right, right. Well, we actually, we held a financial aid night at Thunder Mountain a couple weeks ago, and we had
okay, so folks, you would have had to attend it then.
Right. So at that point, we had that conversation with the students, but the college reps are definitely there to be able to have that conversation and steer them into the direction, because that's a very, very important part of a student's choice as to which school they want to go to is based on grants, loans, any kind of scholarships that they may be able to get from that school.
No doubt. And I was asking about relocation counselors because in a lot of cases, it's a culture shock to exit the big fish in little pond experience in Juneau, and suddenly you're the little fish in a much larger world somewhere down in the lower 48 going to school.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so that's one of the things we have the kids look at. One of the things that I always advise the kids to do is that when they're traveling, because we know Alaskans like to travel, when they're traveling out of state, that they get onto some of these campuses so they get an idea of what a school that's got 5,000 students at it versus one that has 1,000 students. Have them go out to UAS and look so they can kind of get that feel, because you're absolutely correct. It can be quite a shock, and some students are ready to be sitting in a classroom with 300 other students, and some aren't quite ready for that yet. So having them have that opportunity to get on some of these campuses is great. And unfortunately, we don't have anybody that kind of helps them understand the difference between being in a classroom as big as their graduating class opposed to one that's as big as one of their high school classes.
That's probably going to be up to some peers that have already left the scene here and come back and tell them this is kind of what you expect. And, you know, hopefully they can connect with somebody that's already attending the college or vocational school of their choice and be able to go and talk to them and get a little bit more of the down low of exactly what to expect.
Absolutely. And on that note, you're kind of helping me lead into some things here.
That's what I wanted to do, is help you lead into this. Okay, go ahead.
So we usually, in January, we have an alumni session for the students. And we usually will pull from the kids that graduated the year before and have them come back and talk about what their first semester was like. Was it what they expected and what their class sizes are like and how they felt in the different classes and the tricks that they're learning to make their academic success. And so it's really good for the students to hear the kids that they've seen kind of go through the process, come back and say, wow, you know, I picked a school and it was 300 kids in my psych class and it was just crazy, but this is how I got over it. Or the kid who came back and said, yeah, that rocked being a class with 300 people. I just, you know, they like it. And so it's, we do that in January. We have the alumni come back and talk with the students one-on-one and in groups to just kind of give them an idea of how it felt.
All right, Terry, what else do you do in the meantime?
What do I do in the meantime? Well, that's a good question. So I am actually a school district employee now, but I actually am the career advisor at both JDHS and Thunder Mountain. So I'm at JDHS 2 days a week. My office is there on Wednesdays and Fridays. And then I'm out at Thunder Mountain on Mondays and Thursdays. And I work with the kids on their post-high school planning, whether they've decided to go into the workforce or they're going to apply for colleges or look at military. I'm there to help support them in that post-high school planning process at both schools.
All right, Terry. And remind everybody again when the college fair is and can most of the people that are in the high school level attend, or is it mostly just juniors and seniors?
So we alternate years for the host school.
Right.
And the year that we have what we call the traveling school, which this year will be Thunder Mountain, we bring our juniors and seniors down. And then the host school, which is JDHS, all their classes will have the opportunity to go through the college fair. So every other year we open it up to the host school who gets to do it longer.
Okay, that's how it works.
Yeah. So the thing to be thinking about time-wise, it is this Thursday. We will have the Thunder Mountain Yakus and some younger students come in the morning, and then the JDHS kids will be in the afternoon, and a community open house is from 5 to 6. Parents, if you can't come between 5 and 6, if the doors are open, you're welcome to come on in. You'll just probably get a little bit more time with the reps between 5 and 6. There won't be so many kids there.
All right. Terry Calvin, thank you very much for being our guest on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
This is Bird Note. Almost any time of the year when you visit the ocean shoreline, Pacific, Atlantic, or the Gulf of Mexico, you're likely to find a batch of sandpipers and plovers, small to medium-sized birds running along the retreating wave edge, probing in the mudflats, or flying up suddenly in a tight flock. They are such a familiar presence near the water's edge that the whole group of them, plovers, sandpipers, and several others, is known officially as shorebirds. But shorebirds' lives take them to many places other than the shore. Most migrate to the Arctic in summer, where many nest on the tundra, some along rushing streams, and others on rocky mountainsides. The long-billed curlew, which winters on the Florida, Gulf, and Pacific coasts, nests in the grasslands and sagebrush of the arid west, about as unshore-like as it gets. And one of the most familiar of shorebirds, the handsome plover called the killdeer, is a year-round habitué of open farmlands, park lawns, and plowed fields. So it's only on a few lucky days that you might see one at the shore. Bird Note is produced by John Kessler, and our executive producer is Dominic Black. Today's show was written by Bird Note's lead writer, Bob Sundstrom.
During the 1800s in Britain, women could not own land or houses, so a loving mother of four girls is urgently pursuing financial security for her daughters in the shape of husbands, turning all of their lives upside down in this witty drama of friendship, rivalry, enmity, and love. Don't miss JDHS Theater Department's heartwarming production of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, October 16th, 17th, 18th at 7 p.m., and October 18th at 2 p.m. at the JDHS Auditorium. Tickets available at Hearthside Books or jahc.org.
And I'd like to apologize for that bad recording of Simon and Garfunkel's Scarborough Fair. So I'm going to treat you to a little bit of Billy Joel's Scenes from an Italian Restaurant as this talk about garlic and all this other stuff with herbs and, you know, everything else, garlic. It's all kind of been making me hungry. So let's go into a little bit of Scenes from an Italian Restaurant, and I'll be back in a few minutes with the weather.
In our old familiar place, you and I, face to face.
During the 1800s,
a bottle of whites. It all depends upon your appetite. I'll meet you anytime you want in our Italian restaurant.
Kind of life. Oh, but there we were waving Brenda.
And that was a little bit of Billy Joel's Scenes from an Italian Restaurant. Man, that's making me hungry for a plate of lasagna or something. All right, tonight's forecast. Let's get to it. Mostly cloudy, scattered rain showers, mainly late. Lows around 40 with southeast winds at 10 miles an hour. Near Juneau and Douglas, northeast winds at 10 to 20 miles an hour with gusts to 30 late. Tomorrow, rain showers likely with highs in the upper 40s and southeast winds at 10 to 20 miles an hour. And tomorrow night, rain showers likely with lows in the upper 30s to low 40s and southeast winds at 10 to 15 miles an hour. You are listening to KTOO in Juneau. We rebroadcast on we broadcast on 104.3 in downtown Juneau and Douglas, and we rebroadcast on the following translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay areas, you can tune to K276 AF 103.1, Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K269 AO at 101.7, Gustavus listens in on K201 AM 88.1, K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9, Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9, and in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on digital channel 871 for GCI Cable. You've been listening to a Juneau Afternoon. We're going to join All Things Considered. Have a great day, everybody.
One of the strategies now we have is to listen to the story. Because if you go by that checklist, do you have fever? Are you vomiting? Everything is denied.
In Liberia, the effort to keep Ebola out of a key hospital. It's Tuesday, October 14th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. In this hour, we'll hear from U.S. doctors and nurses who are stepping up to volunteer.